joined on my panel this morning by Chief Judge Susan Siegel and Judge Peter Reyes. It is Wednesday, May 26th. The next case on our calendar for oral argument is Varvara Tyshchenko versus Joseph Camille. I apologize if I mispronounced any or both of those names. Counsel, I know you are familiar with our procedures. You will each have 15 minutes to present your argument. It's important that when you are not arguing that you mute your audio. We find that that makes for the smoothest record and hearing for everyone else. It's also important that you state your name and identify the name of the party you represent when you begin your argument. And with that, and be mindful of the time, it indicated, I guess, on my screen on the top left-hand corner, if you are in gallery view, that should be evident to you as well. With that, Counselor for Appellant, Ms. Abul Hassan, you may proceed.
Good morning, everybody. This is Nahid Abul Hassan, appearing on behalf of the appellant, Joseph Smail. As the court is familiar, that Mr. Smail appeared challenging six determinations by the district court. It is custody, parenting time, the calculation of my client's income, the tax dependence exemption, and the division of marital, non-marital assets, and his right to collect his work tools and personal belongings from the marital home. With regard to custody, the best interest factors are examined by the court. And I believe this is one of the examples when the court goes through making findings, analyzing the best interest factors, but the conclusion of the law of the court is different than what the court analyzed. Here, when we go through, as I detailed in my brief, we go through the analysis of the best interest factors, the court will find out that all these factors support awarding joint physical custody. The court in both sides made determination or made finding that the parties are equally participating in the child's life.
Ms. Abul Hassan, I'd like to stop you for a moment. I understand the arguments you're making. It seems to me that the fact that you or this court might weigh the factors differently than the district court did here, I mean, that may be true, but based on our review of the case, we have to find abuse of discretion to disturb the district court's findings. What specifically would lead us to conclude that the district court in weighing the custody factors abused its discretion?
Yes, the district court abused its discretion when it made conclusions that are not based on the findings of facts the court made itself. The finding of facts lead to joint legal custody. The court weighed on each party's participation. The court clearly said the child would benefit from having to spend time, to have custody. They are in the same location. The child, changing the home or sharing the home is not going to change the structure of the stability of the child. All of the 12 factors analysis would lead to joint physical custody. But when it came to the conclusion, the court abuses discretion because it made a conclusion not based on the fact or finding of fact, sorry. So that's my argument with regard to the abuse of discretion when it came to custody. We don't have any allegation about that there is a domestic abuse against the child. The court clearly made findings that in the past, the parties struggled when they lived together. My client agreed to no contact order, yet they agreed to have joint legal custody.
That's but another- Ms. Abul Hassan, or Hassan, I mean, it is also true. The district court, as I read the findings, very carefully sifted through all of the factors and seemed to me to be persuaded by the fact that that mother, the respondent here, has been the primary caretaker of the child up to this time. And do you quarrel with that finding of fact?
I disagree with that fact. At the time the court made this decision, both parties, half of the child's life was with dad being available for the child after the after dad sustained a work injury, and that's his time. The court relied on a period of a few months when mother prevented having access to the child, and she entered logs therapy. At the same time, my client had no contact with mother, so it cannot be used against my client that he was prevented at that period of time to have access to the child, yet and claim that he wasn't available for the child.
Are you referring to finding of fact number 6?
I believe so.
I just want to make sure we're clear in terms of which finding of fact we're discussing at this point.
I am referring to the Exhibit 3 in the court file where she entered reading logs between a specific time, but at that time, she prevented my client to have access to the child. She didn't reveal her location. The only way my client got access to the child by going to school early and picking up the child for Easter. Yet she called the police claiming that the child should go with her. So all of this evidence we presented to court will show that my client did his best during this period the court considered to show that mother took care of the child. He did his best to get access to the child. But mother prevented him and used it against him.
Aren't we talking about, when we're looking at factor 6, the history and nature of each parent's participation in providing care for the child? The district court stated that mother has been providing the majority of the day-to-day care for the child. And I thought the record seemed to reflect that even father's own testimony was that his work schedule prevented him from spending time with the child. So I think what the district court was looking at was the history of who had taken care of the child, not just the more recent history of what happened with respect to the any domestic abuse allegations. This is more long-term. So
yeah, but that schedule was changed in 2017. So the main issues here, actually, I believe the court relied on that the child got adjusted to the temporary parenting time, but the law is clear, 518.131, temporary order should not prejudice the child or the father. Mother's main argument in this case is that the child is used to the schedule right now, and she claimed that the father, it was his choice to work and not take care of them. The court rejected that argument. And that's in the transcript page, index number 107, page 27. And the court clearly rejected that argument. It clearly said he cannot be in two places. Yes, he has to provide for the family. Yes, but the court, here I'm looking at it. That is in index number 106, page 68. The main argument is that mother wanted to preserve she wanted to preserve what the parties have followed for a year, that mother here referring to the contemporary parenting time. I would like to move to the other issues if the court would allow me, because my time is running low. With regard to the parenting time, again, the child spend specific time with his dad based on a temporary parenting schedule. All what that asks for is one extra night. Instead of returning the child on Monday after school, when he picks him up from after school and return him at 7:30, that asks the court to allow him to have that night. And if the court failed to explain how trusting dad to have the child spend Wednesday night, get him to school in the morning, but it would not be okay to have dad spend one night on Monday and get him to school on Tuesday. There is no allegation to limit dad's parenting time, no allegation of abuse to limit parenting time with the child. The parties live in the same area very much. And that schedule, we provided his schedule, has been very stable since he had the back injury. He is now working a lot. Another factor that dad worked a lot because he took care of most of the financial obligation, including paying for about 4 or 5 mortgages.
Counsel, I'd like to turn your attention and your remaining time to the question of finances, because one of the arguments you're making to this court is that the district court clearly erred in its findings with respect to your client's income for child support purposes. And I want to focus you on the record. And my question is, what record evidence supports your contention that husband's ordinary and necessary business expenses in 2018, which is the last year we focused on, exceeded $125,000?
I provided counsel, former counsel who represented mother in a trial several times, all bank statements showing my client uses these accounts for business expenses. At trial, counsel denied that. We then introduced evidence to show this is what was given to counsel several times. And I also included an exhibit list of all the bank accounts that went along with the bank statements themselves. The court did not address the reason why I gave that. I overcome the allegation by providing, by getting the court attention to other exhibits showing that my client business expenses are not only in the American Express credit card, but there are other statements on file the court to look at to see if there are additional ones.
So with respect to the credit card statements, I'm actually looking at Exhibit 91 from the trial, which I believe is a list of financial documents you put together. And in for the Discoverer, the Capital One, the Amex, Chase, all of those credit card statements are identified as marital debts. If that's true, how can he also claim those as his business expenses?
No, we provided this to show that there are other statements to show business expenses. For example, one of these accounts is a business account. There are bank statements, and the list is to demonstrate that we did give all the bank statements to show that my client has other expenses from other places. And the respondent just chose American Express. If we
can I interrupt and ask a quick question? Sure. My understanding from the record is that your client was asked to provide documentation of business expenses, and your client chose to provide the American Express bill. So, but then later submitted this exhibit. I mean, at some point,
you're
kind of stuck with what you're providing, right?
I gave all the bank statement, but to prove that we gave her and there are other statement to show their other business expenses in other accounts, I directed the court to look at other exhibits that we submitted to show the valuation date, what was in the party's account. And this statement shows all other business expenses, and the court disregarded that. Counsel for the respondent denied receiving this multiple times from me. I gave the court verification she received them, and here is the proof. And if you want it, you want to see if I'm telling you this is the proof, look at the bank statement we submitted to show the valuation date. You will find all business expenses there. The court disregarded that. In addition, the Exhibit 91 I submitted includes about $4,000-$5,000 insurance for the truck. The court also disregarded that. So the calculation of the business expenses has been inaccurate in this case, even though the court had all the documents to look at. I know my time is up.
Counsel, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal, yes, should you choose to use it. Thank you, counsel. If you could put yourself back on mute now, and we will turn to the argument of respondents, counsel. Ms. Shellberg, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Judge Borkman, Your Honors, may it please the court. My name is Carla Shellberg. I represent the respondent in this matter. As the court has already directed our attention, the important issue here is the standard of review. The standard of review, because there are no legal claims raised in this appeal, is an abuse of discretion. But more importantly, all of the issues that are raised in the argument of counsel have to do with credibility. I mean, if you look at the financial issues, the court properly determined what you were just talking about with was regard to the proof of necessary business expenses. It's very clear that 518A.30 makes that burden on the appellant. And the court specifically said in that analysis, not only was the evidence not provided, which is his duty, but he found that his presentation on that issue was not credible. And that determination, that credibility determination, is completely within the discretion of the court, as is the other financial issue that was raised. And I think I interpreted it correctly, although I have to say that appellant's brief was unclear, which is their challenge of the marital, non-marital division of the property. Now, the parties had already determined what the non-marital interests were of the various real properties, and that was submitted to the court, so there can't be any challenge there. I believe what the challenge is that the court found that some of the debt submitted by both parties was not proven. And particularly, the court found that debt of judgments, of medical expenses submitted by the appellant, he had not, one, established the burden of proof to prove that that was marital debt, and two, that his credibility was severely lacking, and if the court reads the findings, there are very specific findings the court made with regard to how that testimony, with regard to those bills, particularly the judgments. The judgments appear to be older than the marriage. There was no evidence that submitted that there were actually marital debt. And more importantly, there was no evidence submitted that they were active, you know, that they were actually being pursued so that they should be put on the asset liability sheet with regard to equalization. Again, that's credibility. We also need to look to the other standards with regard to discretion. I mean, there's discretion and then there's discretion, right? The court's given complete discretion with regard to whether and how it allocates the tax exemptions. Complete discretion. There is no case law that I can find that indicates that that is not wholly within the discretion of the trial court.
Can I ask you a question about the custody decision, which again, I understand our standard of review is limited, but as I understand appellant's argument, the focus is that the district court in fact abused its discretion by focusing on too narrow of a time period when it, you know, made its assessment about the role of the respective parents in terms of parenting, and that the court should look at more than the few months that the child was out of father's care because of the OFP being in place. But that the court should look more broadly and including the fact that father's situation changed in 2017 and he wasn't working the sort of hours he had been before and presumably would be more available to parent. How do you respond to that argument?
Well, I think it's important to look at all of the findings. I mean, the court was really careful in doing its job. It made numerous findings, and it made findings with regard to this issue that applied to very different factors. So, yes, the court found, and I believe that if you read them carefully, it found it over a long period of time that the history of this case was that the respondent provided the care for the child. Now, that not only affects criteria six, but it also affects other factors because this is what the court found that rose from that or came from that, which is the stability of the child has been established in the care of the respondent, that his security is established in the care. It's not just time, it's who did all of the development for the activities, for the schooling, for everything else, that his patterns, that his emotional bonding was with the appellant due to her history of that care. And that is not against the legal standard. You know, you're not supposed to take one factor over the other. You're not supposed to say that because you're the primary caregiver, therefore you get custody. We're past that time, and the court recognized that and looked at each and every factor. But that history, the fact that she's the one that has done all this work, that he is accustomed to her care, that he is accustomed to the bonding between them, that relates to other factors. And the court found that they all favored, except for one, all favored the respondent.
Or were neutral. I mean, as I read it, I thought that a number of them, five maybe favored mother, that five were neutral and that one favored father.
You're right, Your Honor. I simplified in a way that may not have been accurate. But if the court looks to the findings, and every district court must look at all the facts, must make factual findings on everything that's presented, and then must do a balancing between those factors. And that is well reasoned in this decision and well within the court's discretion. And I think if you look at it, it's probably the decision another court would have made. Although it's very clear that that can't be the standard, right? We have the court, I'm looking for my, sorry, Your Honor. But just because the record could support different findings, Elliot Mitchell says that the trial court doesn't have to make those findings, that just because a record can give rise to other findings, it's not defective and it is not against the discretion of the court. So let's go back to the financial issue because this is critical. And that's the findings of his income. I want to make it really clear to the court that he is an independent contractor. Therefore, he has to be looked at that he runs his own business. The court took his gross receipts, which there was no argument about, and then applied the standard as to proof of necessary business expenses. The appellant seems to argue that just because they're allowable under tax deductions, that they should have been applied here. Well, that's not the law. And specifically, it's not the law. Under 518A.30, it clearly lays out what can be allowed. You can't take depreciation. You can't take other kinds of expenses that aren't actual, that don't actually come off your balance sheet.
But that you don't actually expend money on. But right. I mean, it seems to me that father submitted all kinds of records, all of these bank statements that were, you know, the bank statements were for his business, not for the family. And maybe you quibble about some of the items that were paid out of those bank statements. But I mean, the district court treated this as if there was no records provided by father. And I'm not sure that that's true.
Well, the court recognized that the primary record was the American Express bill. The court was extremely concerned about the credibility issue. And there were men, and I was not the lawyer of trial, Your Honor. And so I apologize if I may make a misstatement here. But reading the decision, the court found that the American Express bill was presented by respondent appellant as the major proof of his expenses. And the court was extremely concerned about credibility here. And the court needs to recognize that the district court can determine credibility completely and should, because that's who's before them. No one else has a better view. And he made detailed findings of how the things that were submitted to be counted as necessary business expenses, he later testified, were him buying coffee for his employees. And those findings are quite detailed. It goes into absolute specificity with regard to where the court found he lacked in credibility. And he could not, after you read all of that, all of the decision, he could not find that the appellant had met his burden with regard to additional necessary expenses. If I can go again to the issue of the marital, non-marital division, I also
particularly interested in your remaining time and in having you discuss the personal property items. They may not be the biggest issue from a monetary standpoint, but I don't understand how we can square the district court's amended finding of fact number 80 with, you know, and I'm looking at the transcript with your client's apparent agreement that he can keep the tools and the lawnmower and things that are in the garage. And how do we reconcile the amended findings in that regard?
Your Honor, I'll be honest with you. I'm not sure you can. I do think that he has discretion. It may have been an error, but I need to be honest with the court. I looked at the record. There doesn't appear to be anything that would counter my client's, either in the submission of the affidavit or anywhere else, that would counter my client's statement at trial. Is that sufficient, Your Honor?
So, I mean, to the extent that isn't supported, that would be a narrow remand on at least that issue.
Yes, a very narrow remand, Your Honor. But if I can, counsel did not flush out so much her argument with regard to the non-marital, marital division. I really think it comes down to these debts. And I, again, believe that the court made very critical findings and specified findings with regard to proof and credibility as to what should be considered a marital debt or not. And I'd like to point out the fact that both parties said medical debt should be included on their side of the balance sheet. And in fact, he didn't allow either one because he found that both parties did what, which is common, submit statements that have written all over them, this is not a bill, this is not a bill. And because they had not appropriately weighted and submitted the bills after the insurance payments. And so he evenly, there's no bias here. He evenly applied the standard with regard to proof of marital versus non-marital debt and what should be applied on the balance sheet. And the majority of the debt that he did not allow was debt that was a result of old judgments that could not, based on the record, be identified as marital property. And the second part is that they have to be real. They have to be actual judgments. A lot of people have judgments that are no longer enforced. There's no real danger that they would be required to pay. And that's what he found. And again, that burden is on the appellant. Your Honor, that concludes my argument, unless there are any other questions. I would ask that the decision be affirmed. And if it is remanded, only on that very small issue of personal property. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, counsel.
I also have permission to sit down.
You may do so.
Thank you.
Ms. Abul Hassan, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal. And I think you need to come off mute.
Thank you, Your Honor. Talking about my client's income, counsel kept repeating it's about credibility. Documents don't lie. The court considered only the American Express statement as source of my client expenses. The court relies on what was introduced as trial record as Exhibit 150, which was an email from me to opposing counsel saying, here is the rest of the bank statement or the American Express statement you were waiting for. My client testified, and I'm not going to say if he was credible or not because we're not here for that. But I directed the court by my motion for amended finding to look at Exhibit 65, which was marked as page 250-257, showing gas purchases, transmission, replacement, and many other parts that the court did not take into consideration. Exhibit 79, page 432, I requesting counsel for respondent asking for all documents showing his business expenses. Also page 443 stating that the same exhibit that I stated to counsel that I have provided the bank statement several times. Exhibit 81, page 469, informing counsel that the bank statement have been provided several times as part of the formal discovery. I listed and I tried to assist the court by giving all these other exhibits on file or part of the record to look at other business expenses, and the court deliberately ignored these exhibits. They all show business expenses, auto parts, transmission replacement, gas purchases. My client is a driver. He drives for a company. He spent over $100 a day in gas purchases. That's a lot. And that's the court, what the court ignored. Exhibit 91 was a summary of business expenses. Exhibit 93, which is a list showing all the transaction which was provided to counsel, and counsel, the court again ignored that fact. With regard.
Does the fact, counsel, that the district court didn't make the findings you proposed mean the court ignored the evidence? I appreciate that you don't agree with the district court findings, but is there anything in the record that suggests that the district court did not consider any evidence that was offered?
Yeah, I demonstrated that by my motion for amended finding, I directed the court to look at which exhibit to know that my client has other business expenses that the court did not look at. I specifically cited the same exhibit I presented or I spoke about today, and the court denied my amended finding without even looking at this exhibit. And the court claimed that my motion for amended finding was a motion for reconsideration. We went beyond that era of 1998, but the court is still looking at if the motion is a motion for amended finding or a motion for reconsideration. So the court blocked it by stating that, but the court did not look at this exhibit I listed in my motion for amended finding to see if there are other business expenses there or not. That's what I mean that the court denied, ignored the records. With regard to the division of marital property, the pertinent proof here is on the respondent to show whatever debt is out there is non-marital. She failed to meet her burden of proof. And I'm here quoting Johnson v. Johnson. It's clear the non-marital claim must be proved by a preponderance of the evidence. She failed. She provided judgment that had been renewed and they're still getting renewed. They affect my client's credit. To overcome her claim, we pointed the court to her own social security statement. All these years where this judgment or this debt was accumulating, she did not make any money. She was dependent on my client who had to meet 4 or 5 mortgages in addition to financing her trips to Russia. The respondent did not work for many years. And even when she worked, she made about $5,000 a month. I mean, a year. So she failed to meet her burden of proof. For that reason, this case has to be returned to the court to redetermine the marital debt.
Thank you, counsel. The matter is submitted. We will take the matter under advisement and issue our decision within the statutory 90-day period. So thank you both. This will conclude the oral portion of today's calendar, so we are in recess.
Thank you.